On today's show, I want you to think about this line of country music. It comes from someone you're going to hear from later and goes like this. Had somebody that I trusted leave me broke and busted. That's a pretty perfect distillation of what it feels like to be brokenhearted, artistic, and poor in all senses of that word. And that's what today's show is all about, the place where art and money intersect. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. Just about all of us consume some kind of art, music, TV, theater, even a ceramic mug. And of course, those things are a business. Someone makes them, someone sells them, someone gets paid, or not. Starving artist is not a cliche for nothing. That's what we're doing today, exploring the economics behind all that creativity. Come tell us where art and commerce intersect in your life. We're at MarketplaceWeekend.org, on Facebook, or Twitter, at MarketplaceWKND. We're going to start the show with a creative business that Americans consume a lot, TV. Nielsen said the TV industry was worth about $74 billion last year, and that doesn't count digital video. And for the last couple of weeks, television reporters have been huddled in a hotel ballroom in Beverly Hills, listening to show creators, executives, and actors try to persuade them that what they've made is worth watching in an increasingly competitive field. Marketplace's Adrienne Hill is there at the Television Critics Association, and I started by asking her, why is there so much good TV right now?
Well, I think part of it is just there's so much competition, and all of these studios and networks are trying to figure out how to make money, and to do that, they need to grab our attention. And to do that, they need to tell stories and really good stories that are going to get us watching and keep us watching. I think another thing is really quality begets quality. So television's become better and better. It's attracting better known writers, better known directors and actors. And you just see a lot of the most creative work happening in Hollywood right now happening on television.
Well, so how does that affect the output and what we get?
Well, for studio executives, I think they're looking at how to put a show on the air that's really going to capture our attention right away. Because it's so competitive, because there are so many hours and hours and hours of television, a show really needs to grab people's attention to be special and stand out. I think that's part of the reason we're seeing really interesting stories on one hand. And I think it's, you know, we're also seeing lots of reboots of characters that we know, of stories that we know, trying to sort of capitalize on the fact we already have a connection with characters. For creators, I think it's trickier because they want to tell authentic stories and they want to tell good stories. I threw the question out to Michelle Ashford, who's the creator and executive producer of Masters of Sex on Showtime.
I think one of the things that we're trying not to fall into is that it's so competitive now, just even getting your show seen and paid attention to. Sometimes you have to do all sorts of fireworks. We just don't really have a fireworks kind of show. We're just a storytellers.
I am not even going to touch the fireworks. Okay, and moving on. How does that change the kind of storytelling itself? Does it affect the content?
Well, I think that the competition does. I think we're having a moment right now where studios and networks, creators themselves, really value creativity and authenticity. Also, the rise of video on demand, our love of streaming, mean that we're watching a whole lot of serial television because we're watching these things in order. And so now you can tell really complicated stories. You can tell sort of multi-hour movies, basically, over the course of these episodes. So you get more rich, detailed storytelling. Authenticity is also a word that's been coming up session after session after session here. And it came up in a conversation I had with Aline Brosh McKenna, who's the executive producer of a new show called Crazy Ex-Girlfriend on the CW.
I think what I found and what most writers find is that the more authentic to your own experience you make it, the more authentic it will be to other people, even if the details of it are really specific. So even though she's a lawyer and she's in Southern California and we have songs, the experience, the human experience of it should be relatable. But all you can do ever is speak to yourself and hope it speaks to others as well.
You know, and authenticity is coming up in places like Billions, also on Showtime with the journalist Andrew Ross Sorkin, Blood and Oil, the sort of big soapy drama that's coming out. They actually went up to the Bakken and checked things out there. They're really trying to bring all of the storytelling back to real life to help it connect better with the audiences.
When you think about the audience and consumers and this concept of authenticity, This is a huge and growing market with lots of different kind of people who are paying for content. Does that change who is making television and who they're selling it to?
Well, I think Hollywood is trying. They're at least talking about non-white male show creators and actors. They're working on it, Lizzie. I mean, it has been something that has come up over and over and over again here at the TCA, which is that we really want stories and storytellers that look like all of us in sort of all of the different ways that we are and that we look and that we exist. And there's not just one perspective that's really dominated television for so long. So it doesn't seem like the kind of thing that's going to change instantly. There are definitely some networks and studios taking it more seriously or sort of more focused on it than others. But there is a sense that it's changing and that it's important.
I have been admittedly binge-watching the Danish show Borgen on DVD. I'm like 5 years behind. But what are you watching now?
Catastrophe is great if you haven't seen it. It's on Amazon. Okay. Mr. Robot on USA is amazing. And I'm catching up myself on Revenge. I'm in the first season and kind of addicted.
Dude, Adrian, you're way behind.
I'm way behind.
Marketplace's Adrian Hill, thank you very much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Television is a pretty lucrative creative business, but a lot of artists don't get to have or don't know how to have a mix of creative happiness and financial success. Blending those two things and giving good advice is Corbett Barkley's job. She works as an arts consultant and professor and writes the column The Art Shrink for public broadcaster KCET in California. If you're an artist or aspiring artist, you come to her with questions about how to make a living. Corbett Barkley, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So mixing art and commerce, you know, to my mind sounds in some ways a little unusual. I feel like people become artists because they want to do art, not have to think about money. Am I totally wrong?
No, I think you might be totally right. I think that a lot of artists that I work with really embrace this notion of a starving artist.
Yeah.
You know, the idea that they'll sit in a drafty attic and they'll do their work and they won't be recognized. And also going along with that is this kind of emotional angst that even adds to the romantic, you know, how romantic that idea is. And they buy into that very deeply. And it's hard for them to get over that and get around that. But I think that every artist has to look at their relationship to this idea of starving and angst and correct it before they can have a career that really does provide a living for them also.
I remember that when one of my brothers said he wanted to be a playwright, there were some raised eyebrows. If people say to you, well, wait a minute, how do you make this a viable career? What do you say back?
Well, I say, first of all, look at the number of people who have been successful in the area, particularly things like something like playwriting. You know, there's a history and a legacy of success in these areas. But I think it's a difficult conversation to have with people who are maybe hoping that you would get an MBA. it's a different kind of success. I find that I know people with MBAs who are very successful, but are very attracted to artists because artists have satisfaction in other, they have a deeply personal satisfaction, and maybe they don't make the money, but they tend to be really more satisfied from a deeply personal level. So I don't know, in our society, what we put the biggest value on sometimes is the number of your paycheck. We look at paychecks rather than satisfaction, but I think both of them are equal, and I think it's also very possible that those two things can meet in the middle, and an artist or a creative can also have financial success. And that's the best of both worlds. I mean, that's fantastic.
You've gotten questions recently about online funding, Kickstarters, crowdfunding. I thought this was particularly fascinating. You had some tips for artists who wanted their Kickstarters to do well. I had no idea so many Kickstarters or crowdfunding experiments fail.
Yeah, a lot of them do. And I think there's a way, first of all, to test if you're going to fail, and a way to help ensure that you won't fail. The studies that I did in this area show that if you get to 40% of your goal, I think was the number, then your chances of having success increase by about 90% or so.
Wow.
So my advice to artists is, if you're going to do a Kickstarter campaign, don't just pick a number and cross your fingers. You know the number that you need, have a budget that supports it, and then make sure that you have people who are going to commit to your campaign before you ever put it online. And I always advise artists to make sure, try the best that they can, to have about 50% of their goal, so that your campaign will be active from the time that you launch it till the time you get to the halfway point. And by that time, there'll be more momentum, and you'll find people getting more and more excited about it, because at the end of the day, people want to give to a successful campaign.
What are a few common mistakes that you have seen artists make in your career?
Well, the biggest mistake that I've seen artists make, and the most easily corrected mistake, is that they don't say thank you. And I know that that sounds ridiculous. It sounds ridiculous. But it's true that artists forget to say thank you. And I feel very strongly that that there's great power behind gratitude. I know for a fact that people who either support an artist, either through mentorship or advice or financially, respond very well and very deeply to being told in an appropriate and heartfelt way, thank you. You've made a difference in my career. And it will have a lasting impact, because these are people that will stick with you in the long run. If you don't acknowledge your supporters, they'll go away. They'll find someone else to support.
Corbett Barkley is an arts consultant, educator, and serves as the arts shrink for KCET's Artbound. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're focused on money and creativity in today's show, but we're going to take a short break from that and look at some of the biggest numbers in the news this week. And you can find them all at Marketplace's By the Numbers blog at marketplace.org. Here are our digital producers, Tony Wagner and Tobin Lowe. Tony?
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is
15 months.
That's how long a crop of red lettuce has been growing aboard the International Space Station.
That is, before it got eaten this week.
The feast marked the first time astronauts have chowed down on space-harvested food.
0.8%.
Surprisingly, that's how much Greece's economy grew in the second quarter.
The Greek parliament will soon vote on a new bailout plan.
35 episodes.
That's how many episodes Sesame Street is going to tape each season as part of its new deal with HBO.
That's up from the 18 a season they currently produce on PBS.
The deal also means the next 5 seasons of Sesame Street will go to HBO's family of channels and streaming services.
I think that Elmo may be the voice of my generation, or at least a voice of a generation. How is my Lena Dunham, Tony?
Terrible.
Last month, Amazon launched a new experiment, part album, part playlist. It's called Amazon Acoustics, a group of songs performed by 32 different artists. Some are covers of songs you've heard before, and some are original. The songs are available to stream for Amazon Prime customers and for other people who want to buy them outright online. What the playlist represents, though, is something that companies are spending more time and money on lately: exclusive content. Think of it as Amazon as a fledgling music label. We're going to talk with one of the musicians in a moment, but first, the executive behind the project. Steve Boom is the vice president of digital music for Amazon. Welcome to Marketplace Weekend.
Thanks for having me.
How did Amazon Acoustics start? I mean, who came up with this project?
You know, we had this idea that we wanted to start producing original music and delivering that to our customers and giving them something, a little bit different maybe a little different take on some stuff they're familiar with or themes they're familiar with. And we started it actually at the end of last year. Our first project was holiday music that we
right.
launched. As you can imagine, pretty important time of year for Amazon, obviously, the Christmas season, the holiday season. And that was a big success. And so as we came into 2015, we said, well, you know, what are we going to do next? And this is that. We thought that we could do a new cool project. And we hit upon the acoustics theme really because we wanted to do something that kind of stripped away all the other stuff around music and really just focuses on two things, really, the song and the artist and the singer. And, you know, we think we've done that with Amazon Acoustics, which ultimately is a playlist of 30 songs with some artists that everybody knows, but, you know, mixed with a bunch of artists that, you know, we're giving a chance to be known to a bunch of customers.
Yeah, this is a very eclectic list of musicians. I mean, Nick Lowe to Dyrtek. I'm trying to figure out
Train,
who is your...
Five for Fighting.
Yeah, I looked at this and thought, like, wait a minute, this doesn't have a natural cohesion to it.
Well, you know, it's funny. The cohesion is in the theme. The cohesion's really in the acoustic, is in the fact that it's acoustic. We weren't going for a single genre. In fact, quite the opposite. The cool thing about a playlist is it allows you not to try to make an album, which isn't what we're doing here, where it does have to kind of have this artistic cohesion or a theme that goes all the way through it. But in fact, by going the acoustic route, it allowed us to have a wide variety of artists, and those artists are even, you know, dealing with a wide variety of songs, whether they're their own songs or they're covering someone else's songs. We've got songs anywhere from a Bowie song being covered to Burt Bacharach. So, but when you listen to it, it all hangs together. And that's the beauty of it going acoustic.
You know, no company like Amazon does this without a larger goal in mind down the road. So is this what, the beginning of Amazon Studios, the Amazon label? Is this all about producing exclusive content a year, two, five from now?
First, I'm going to tell you we're going to do a lot more of this stuff. So more genres, more projects, different ideas. You'll see some more projects coming this year. The next one you'll see in the fall, we're going to do some interesting things with children's music. Where it's going to be 5 years from now, 10 years from now, I'm not really sure. I just know that we're going to be doing a lot more of this. But yeah, we want to deliver some things to our customers that they can't get anywhere else.
How is this entry the beginning of what? Competition against Spotify, Apple Music? Those are pretty massive distributors.
Look, we launched Prime Music a year ago. So this is Amazon's entry into streaming. We launched in the U.S. in June of 2014. And
yeah.
That was, you know, we've given Prime members access to a really big catalog of music that they can stream as part of their Prime membership. A year later, it's one of the top streaming services in the U.S. It's, you know, we've got several million people using it every month. In fact, it's successful enough that we just launched it in the U.K. 2 weeks ago, and we're going to launch it in some other countries later this year. So, you know, that's our focus. You know, we're pretty comfortable with where we are and the growth of Prime Music.
What do the artists get out of this, do you think?
A bunch of things. I think for some of them, it's freedom, artistic freedom to go scratch an itch that they couldn't otherwise. You know, some of these artists, they've had songs they've wanted to perform, but they haven't really had the right outlet to do that because traditionally they're going down the normal album route. For other artists, you know, this is about being introduced to millions of customers and finding new lifelong fans. You know, I mean, here's a good example that, you know, that I personally experienced. There's a track on this playlist called by a band called The Silent Film, and they did a cover of Iran. And if you remember that song, I don't know how old you are, Lizzie, but I've got a couple years.
I'm not telling you.
Yeah, I'm not. I won't ask. But so that's a cover of a song by Flock of Seagulls, which came out in the early 80s.
Yeah.
I grew up with that song, so I'm going to date myself. You know, that is a classic early 80s new wave synthesizers, big hair kind of song. This indie rock, alt rock band out of the UK covered it. I didn't really know much about A Silent Film, but if you listen to this track, it just blows you away. It's got nothing to do with the original song other than the lyrics. Personally, I now can't wait. I've now gone and listened to everything that A Silent Film has ever made and happens all to be in Prime Music, which is great. And I can't wait for them to come tour, and hopefully they'll come by to Seattle.
Steve Boom, Vice President of Digital Music for Amazon. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.
And I ran so far away. I just.
Now we're going to hear from one of the artists who worked on the Amazon Acoustics album. And I quoted her at the top of the show with that line of music. Her name is Ashley Monroe, and on that album, she sings the John Mellencamp song Pink Houses, obviously a cover song. But I asked her what original lyrics she'd written that really meant something to her. And she responded with a song called From Time to Time. It came to her in her sleep.
Hush, little darling, celebrate. Today's gonna be your birthday, even if it's not the 10th of September. Sometimes down here you will find life won't give you peace of mind. It's like you're holding on to a dying ember. Anyway, it was that.
You have this record out. It's doing really well right now. When you have your own original music out there, why did you pick Pink Houses to cover? Little Pink Houses.
I like, you know, I think you can hear the words, you know, you slow down a song like Pink Houses, and a lot of people are used to dancing to it and just kind of getting lost in it. And even myself, when I started learning the words, I was like, wow, this is such a different take to be able to, you know, hear it kind of stripped down and even a girl singing it.
Yeah, it's a pretty sad song.
It is kind of depressing. That's my style, though.
When you think about what you do, how much of it is about the music and how much of it is about creating a viable, successful business?
You know, you have to think about both. I mean, especially when you have a band that you have to take care of and a crew and you know, management. And, you know, you obviously have to stay aware of money. I try to make sure that everyone else is taken care of before me, especially in the early stages, because I feel like that if we're all doing it for the right reasons and doing it the right way, that it'll pay off later. If it gets too much in my head, I might get discouraged.
Nashville is an interesting place to be a female songwriter. Does the Amazon deal get you to a wider audience that maybe you wouldn't necessarily get just straight out of Nashville?
I think it definitely does. I mean, Amazon is huge. So, you know, for someone just to randomly click upon my song on Amazon, they have a good chance of not knowing who I am, and hopefully they like it.
Did you grow up thinking about money? You had an entry into the music world when you were quite young. You lost a parent. How much did being financially secure figure in the back of your mind?
I never really thought about money growing up. I think we were fine. I don't think we were rich or poor. I think we were just kind of normal. If we were poor, I wouldn't have known it. We were very much loved and taken care of. So, yeah, I didn't really think about money until after my dad died. And then I remember the first time I thought about it after was going to the funeral home and seeing how much stone was and thinking, oh, my gosh, are we going to be able to afford this? It was like my first dealing with money, kind of.
When you think about the industry now, is it different than what you thought it would be when you were, you know, a teenager picturing being a well-known country artist?
You know, of course, I used to see buses backstage when I would go see shows, and I would think, oh, they're drinking champagne and they're getting their hair done, and oh, we're probably getting a massage. And probably, unless you're Beyonce, that's not the case, and maybe not even her, but I'm still going to imagine somebody does that. But yeah, it's not like what you think. You know, truth is, you're like trying to like curl your hair enough where people think you're like clean. you haven't bathed in 3 days. I mean, it's rough out there, but I love it. I wouldn't take it any other way. But it is funny, all the things that the more I get into it, I'm like, oh, even the award shows and stuff. It's like, oh, yeah, this isn't what I thought it was. But, oh, well, keep on going.
Ashley Monroe, thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Living in a black neighborhood, he's got an interstate running through his front yard. You know he thinks that he's got it so good. And there's a woman in the kitchen.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. True, streaming is the thing in the music business now, but do you remember 10 tapes for a penny? If you grew up in the 80s or 90s, you probably do. And ordered them from Columbia House on some weird contract that you probably couldn't figure out how to get out of. This week, Columbia House filed for bankruptcy protection, and that prompted The Washington Post's Soraya Nadia McDonald to share this story of music, adolescence, and figuring out who you are.
When I read that Columbia House filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection, my first reaction was, they were still around? Columbia House was responsible for me cultivating my own musical tastes outside of my parents. The first cultural artifact I could truly claim as my own came as a gift to me from my older and only sister, Carol. It was the debut cassette of hip-hop New Jack swing group called Another Bad Creation. When Coolin' at the Playground, You Know, came out in 1991, our father saw Red, Chris, Mark, Roro, and David in their oversized puffy coats and blanched. To him, they registered as menaces. Carol tried to explain that hip-hop was part of Black culture. My father growled back, "Not my culture." From that point on, it was clear that my appreciation and understanding for pop culture, especially hip-hop culture, lay largely in Carol's hands. It was she who had always ordered the musical contraband that barely registered as original compositions to our parents. We were a Charlie Parker and Tchaikovsky household, but once I became aware of another existence, I spent a lot of time recording Coolio and Mariah Carey off my see-through radio. The straight-A, goody-two-shoes expectations of my parents were hard to shake, though. I was a giant theater geek, so the first time Carol approached me and told me to pick a CD from the Columbia House order form, I chose Barbra Streisand's Back to Broadway. It was such a treat, and she'd allowed me a CD all my own, and I got to choose without any judgment from our parents. As I grew older and my tastes matured, I knew that when Carol asked me what I wanted for my birthday, I could count on her to come through with some Mary J. Blige. She gave me My Life and Share My World, which basically served as the melodramatic soundtrack for my high school years, played proudly on a hand-me-down stereo that came from who else? Carol. Now that we're both adults with busy lives, we still converge over our musical tastes. More than anything, we are unapologetic and slightly unhinged Mariah Carey stans. And I am still waiting for pop music's glitteriest grand diva to breeze through DC again, so I can pay back Carol for all of the oral lifelines she gave me as a nerdy kid growing up in small town North Carolina, courtesy of Columbia House.
Now we're going to slow down a little bit and meet someone who made a business out of her passion, ceramics.
Don't be afraid. I'm not smacking you. Just the clay. That's very good to get rid of frustration, by the way. You had a bad day? Just wedge a little bit of clay and smack it.
Nadege Choplet is a ceramic artist and creator of Choplet Ceramic Studio and Gallery and the Williamsburg Ceramic Center in Brooklyn. She showed us around her studio and told us about the path she took to get here.
And this room is our kiln room that we mostly use for bisque firing, so there is two big kilns there. So the studio in total has five kilns. So it's a lot of electricity bills, a lot. I first got into pottery when I first came to New York City. I was a student at the Beaux-Arts School in Paris, and I got a grant to come study in New York. Ceramics was quite big in New York, and I was very, very curious to get my hand onto clay. And as soon as it happened, I basically totally fell into the pot and never got out. And then I started to teach and then sell my work and eventually open up the studio. I'm really proud of so many of our members who have fallen in love with ceramics and are totally making a living selling their work through Etsy, through Instagram. Instagram is huge now. So yeah, you can totally make a living with ceramics. I make a living selling my work. I also do a lot of commission work, sometimes for other artists and architects, or whoever may need something made in clay. Of course, I also run the ceramic studio. So we have two locations now. For me, being an artist, being able to pay my bills, not being worried at the end of the month, I had the money to pay my bills, but not compromising, not taking any other job but ceramic work. To me, that's a sign of success and happiness. I don't need much more. There is something really quite magical about the wheel. It's so similar to life. There is really a meditation aspect to it. I think that's what keeps me out of therapy. That I do pots. I don't smoke pots. I do pots.
Nadege Choplet makes and teaches ceramics in Brooklyn. There's more Marketplace Weekend just ahead. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Artists aren't strangers to technology, and it's becoming more and more integral to how they work. That's what we're talking about today when you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology. This is Tech in Real Life.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Hello, Ben.
Hi, Lizzie.
It is nice to be back with you.
Yeah, it's nice to have you back.
This week, we are focused on the creative economy, money and art colliding, and you've been doing a series for Marketplace Tech that kind of fits with our theme. Tell me about it.
It does, Lizzie. We've been doing this series this summer called Noisemakers. It's about the technology that musicians and performers love to stick in vans with them as they go on tour or bring into the studio with them. And it's been a lot of fun. So when it comes to creativity, Lizzie, technology can be really important. The definition of technology, of course, is the application of scientific knowledge for practical purposes, especially in industry. And so
it's
in the
very
music,
fancy definition.
I know. And in the music industry, this can mean a lot of things, right? Lighting, projection, sound or amplification equipment, cameras, mics, the list goes on and on.
But you've been looking at sort of new applications that musicians use specifically.
Yeah, I mean, new and old. And this is something that's really interesting that we discovered talking to folks is some of them fall in love with really simple things. So we talked to Nico Case, the songwriter, who talked about her beloved Fender Jazzmaster guitar from the 1960s. We talked to LP of Run the Jewels, who you have also talked to.
Yep.
And he talked about this sampler he's had in his smoky studio since he started making beats back in the 1990s. And one thing that we've learned that's really interesting is that creativity is a form of capital among artists,
what
right?
Do you mean?
It's currency. You sort of like end up being able to generate currency with some of the tools you use. Every artist we talked to for our series either said that their favorite piece of technology expanded or limited how they went about their process. And whether a piece of technology did one or the other, the result was always more art and more artistic currency.
Give me an example of how that works.
Let me tell you about a specific piece of technology. So James McNew, he's a bass player and organ player for the indie rock band Yola Tango. He talked to me actually during a sound check about a guitar that actually has a lot of limitations built into it because of this simple, some would even say toyish piece of technology, but it's exactly what he wants to play with. Take a listen.
It's a kind of crappy, fantastic guitar made by the Tysco company in the 60s, and it just has a very dead, kind of blunt sound to it. I haven't played it in quite a while, and I was just playing it at soundcheck and remembering how much I love that guitar. I think it's the perfect size. The neck is the absolute perfect size for a guy with giant hands, and it's just a real one of a kind.
Okay, so that's one example with old tech. What
sure.
else is out there?
Okay, so this was actually one of my favorites, Lizzie, and it's going to be on Marketplace Tech this coming week, and I'm giving you a special preview
Thank
here.
You.
Money Mark, his real name is Mark Ramos Nishita. He's probably most famous for working with the Beastie Boys, which I'm sure you know. He's this fascinating kind of maker character. He loves to pull stuff apart. He loves to see what's going on backstage, see how things are being amplified. He came into the studio with a tiny little guitar amplifier and some guitar cables, his smartphone, and a quarter. And he was using the quarter to kind of DJ the sound. So he had all of this set up in a way that he sort of completed the electrical circuit by touching the quarter to the ends of these guitar cables. And he did a little demonstration for me that was really cool.
I can make a rhythm by just touching the quarter onto the tips of the signal. And I can actually go along with the rhythm too.
No way. So that's basically closing an electrical circuit and using a smartphone and an amp.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Which is this really interesting combination, right, of this new technology, which is your smartphone, playing a song, and him sort of creating these rhythmic musical elements.
All right. But make this economic for me. Where are the numbers here?
Okay. So just to leave you with a couple of numbers, Lizzie. The National Association of Music Merchants says the U.S. sold about $7 billion worth of musical instruments and recording gear in 2014. So that's apparently an increase of 3% from the year before. Acoustic guitars were the biggest thing, obviously not a super techie item, but it just goes to show you how much musicians really care about the stuff that they use and how much they want to buy more of it and use more of it to generate this kind of creative currency that they use to connect with their fans and do other things in the space.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. And this series is called Noisemakers. Thanks, Ben.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Investing in art can be a pricey business and pretty much outside the financial grasp of most people. So Madeline D'Angelo had the idea to make what's sort of a mutual fund for fine art. She created Arthena, an online platform that allows investors to buy basically an equity share of an art collection, a slice of art, if you will. Madeline D'Angelo, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
What exactly does Arthena do? Explain this concept to me.
So Arthena is an equity crowdfunding platform for tangible assets.
Blah, 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 blah.
I know, which is really confusing. So basically what we do is we create art collections that are led by notable members of the art world that people can directly invest into online. Those collections range from European emerging to New York artists from the 1960s to the 1980s, to post-war artists, to hidden gems from private collection, meaning that this one art advisor goes into these amazing kind of old estates and finds works that literally haven't seen the light of day for the past 50 years.
So the analogy has been made of a mutual fund for art, like you're buying a piece, a sliver of a collection, right?
Exactly. So that's where the equity crowdfunding component comes in. So everyone really thinks that crowdfunding is like Kickstarter or Indiegogo, but those are donation-based platforms. So with equity crowdfunding, you actually are buying a portion of the special purpose vehicle or entity that you're backing.
So you've got four collections right now. How does this work? I come to you and say, I like, I don't know, surrealist painting, and I've got a little bit of money. What do I do?
So the way that we structured it is that I think that's what's really missing in art and e-commerce or art and tech is expertise. So there really isn't a place for the actual market drivers to exist online. So with Arthena, we allow those market drivers to curate.
What's a market driver?
A market driver. So I'd say a market driver are people who are helping to drive the art market or drive growth in the art market.
So a collector or someone who, what, appraises the value of something?
I'd say it's more like an art advisor or a notable curator. So someone who's really discovering the artists, you know, moving them along the gallery chain. So I always joke it's Bushwick to the Lower East Side, to Chelsea, to museums, and placing the work by those artists in the hands of the right collectors to really give them the right buzz and make sure that the right people know about them.
I mean, when I think of the art market, I think of extremely rich people who go to Christie's or Sotheby's and bid on something with a dollar figure that I can't even wrap my mind around.
Well, I think that's what everyone thinks, right? Because when everyone's reading the news and they're looking at all of this great art market data, you know, they see, you know, a Picasso selling for $170 million. And in reality, that's actually a very small portion of the market. The majority of transactions, particularly where Artena focuses in post-war through emerging, are under $50,000. So if you're looking by transaction volume, the majority of works are actually at the lower to middle end of the market.
So what do you have right now, and what could I buy into, and for how much?
So our minimum buy-in is $10,000 per collection, which, you know...
Still a lot of money.
It's still a lot of money. Yeah, no, it is.
Is it ever going to be cheaper, do you think, to invest in art?
I do. I mean, we'd really like to bring down the minimum to $2,500. However, you know, when we go out to some of these institutional investors that are interested in investing with Artena, they also kind of say, $10,000, what am I going to do with that? So conversely, we get a lot of feedback that our minimum's too low. Hmm. And to that, I say, you know, you should invest across multiple collections. And that way you're also tapping into the expertise of multiple advisors. But, you know, I would like to bring that minimum down in the future, but we're still early.
How did you come up with this idea?
Oh, it's
You're 28, right?
I'm 28. Yeah, I know. And I look like I'm 18, too. Yeah, so... I get, sometimes I meet with these notable people in the startup community, and they're like, you're 24 and you've done so much. And it's like, well, I'll let you think that for now. But I've always kind of existed in the art world. My parents are both collectors, but they collect Roman antiquity and early photographs. Hmm. And I've really spent like most of my free time growing up in museums or, you know, going to auctions and art collections. So I worked in a couple of director's offices at some major institutions like the Smithsonian and the MFA Boston and the Guggenheim in Venice. And I noticed that all of these museums were trying to reach out to this wider audience and bring them into the fold. They're like, we know there's people out there that want to be able to participate, but we just can't seem to bring them in. And I'm part of this generation that they're trying to reach out to. And I realized that this generation really looks at art not only from a cultural perspective, which they do, but also a financial perspective. And it makes sense because if you look at how many kids my age have student loans, if you put $10,000 into something, you want to make sure it'll be worth $10,000 the next day.
If I put down $10,000, let's imagine that I even have $10,000 to put down, when am I going to see a return? What kind of return do you imagine your customers will see? And who are those customers?
Oh, well, those are a couple of really good questions. So the collections run for a period of 5 years. 5 years is basically when you can expect to get your money back.
And what am I going to get back return-wise?
I mean, I think that's really hard to say. On average, the post-war and contemporary market returns about 10% year-on-year over the past 5 years. But just my disclaimer, past performance does not indicate future returns.
Yeah, so, you sound like a finance pro.
Oh, I guess I've had to be over, founding this company, but...
How much money have you raised so far, and how many customers do you have?
1.2 million. Precisely.
In startup funding.
In venture capital, yep. And we have around 3,300 customers on the platform.
Where do you want to be in 5 years?
Oh, gosh. Everywhere. You know, I really want Artena to be the tangible asset platform that people go to invest in tangible asset investment online. And I'd like to diversify into different verticals as well. So my background's in art, but we have a lot of people coming to us and saying, hey, can we use your model for, you know, a wine fund or a collectible car fund? Or, you know, we met with a fancy diamond fund yesterday with colored diamonds that, you know, are worth, I don't know, what my company would be at an IPO. So I don't know if they're a great fit for our platform, but it's interesting to see these other verticals.
Madeline D'Angelo is the founder of the art startup Artena. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. If there's a theoretical person who's probably not supposed to care about making money, it's a punk rock star. Part of that kind of studied coolness is affecting nonchalance about material success. But success is exactly what's happening for the Danish band Ice Age. Their third album was reviewed as brilliant, and they're in fashion magazines and on a U.S. tour. I spoke with the band's frontman, Elias Bender Ronenfeldt, in downtown New York, where he was staying with an artist friend. There's a mattress on the floor, some philosophy books, and of course, an ever-present cigarette. I asked him to describe his job to me.
I write records, and I go play them. And I've been doing that for a while now.
You have talked in other interviews about not caring about monetary success. Is that true?
I don't think it should be a criteria for creating something. But no, I think that success should lie in what you've created and not in what kind of acknowledgement what you've created can lead you to.
And yet it must feel good now to have interviews in Vogue and, you know, the fader following you around and things like that. Is there some outward signifier of success that feels good?
I don't get off on it, but I'd probably be kind of pissed off if people weren't paying attention. But I also think that they should. So
why should they?
Well, I believe what I do is definitely worth taking note of.
A lot of people have asked you about this sort of question of whether there's a frontman persona or whether that's you, particularly if you look at, you know, the Lord's Favorite. What do you think?
Sometimes you don't really know. But I still don't really haven't figured out how this works.
You feel like you're figuring it out kind of as it's happening?
I just rarely think why. I do things, but I rarely think of why.
You're very young. Do you feel young in this business? Because you've been doing it for a long time, but you're only, what, 22?
Maybe I'm a little less naive than 4 years ago, but I don't think I was ever that naive. But I don't think there's plenty of people in the music world that are much older than me and has been doing it for longer, but I've yet very dumb people. So it depends on how you measure it, I guess.
At the time of writing, you said you were completely broke. What was that like? What was a day like?
I mean, for writing, it was pretty good because it made it harder to leave the house. Like I was just kind of stuck because at some point I couldn't afford food or a metro ticket anymore. But luckily, I also had some friends I could leech onto. Yeah, my money comes and goes.
What do you think about that? Is this a business that you can make a living in?
Some kind of living. I think I earn less than a cashier in a supermarket, but I make it work. But I think it's kind of weird talking about money like this.
What's your writing process like?
You just have to hope that things will keep coming to you, really.
Does that ever scare you that maybe they won't?
I had like a period after I had just finished Plowing Into the Field of Love. After that, I felt so empty. It was just silent up there. And that was very freaky to me. And I didn't really know how to react. What do you do when you don't have these things?
And what do you do?
I think I'm mostly, let's just say it didn't improve my behavior. Then one day came and things started being there again.
Where do you draw from when you do that?
I don't know. Like I'd like to think of it as just some kind of vacuum cleaner inside my head, and it kind of picks whatever information it wants itself, whether it might be feelings that comes through living or literature or music or like this impression, and it just kind of like gets in the vacuum cleaner and broken apart, and like that it's all these broken pieces of information that like just whirls around in there, and then sometimes two pieces will hit each other and they glue together, and maybe that's where an idea comes from. But it's hard to pinpoint where I draw reference from for me.
Elias Ronenfeldt, thank you.
Cheers. Split in two.
And that's our show for this week. Next week on the show, we're focusing on New Orleans and its people and exploring life 10 years after Katrina. If you live there or were affected by the storm, here's what we want to know. What's changed the most in your post-Katrina economy? Come tell us at marketplaceweekend.org. Our show is produced by Jenny Ament and Raghu Manavalan. Dan Simitovich is our senior producer. And Charlton Thorpe is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.